Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, former President Donald Trump appears in court to argue that he is immune from criminal charges stemming from his time in office.
The Pentagon reveals Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is being treated for prostate cancer, the fallout from his undisclosed surgery and subsequent hospitalization.
And 2023 blows past the last record for the hottest year and nears a critical global warming threshold that countries have been trying to avoid.
There's growing concern among scientists that we may have underestimated just how sensitive the climate, the Earth's temperature, is to greenhouse gases as they increase.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Donald Trump was in court in Washington, D.C. today, while his attorneys argued the former president is immune from federal prosecution connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
The three-judge appeals panel seems skeptical of the Trump legal team's argument that Mr. Trump was acting in his official capacity as president to, quote, ensure election integrity when he undermined the results of the 2020 presidential election.
I think it's paradoxical to say that his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed allows him to violate criminal laws.
NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson was at the courthouse today and is following all of the latest developments. Carrie, thanks so much for being with us. And we should say this case is not just about Donald Trump. It's about the presidency and the powers of the presidency. How did Mr. Trump's legal team argue that he should be immune from criminal charges relating to his efforts to overturn the election? What was the case they made in court today?
Trump's lawyer, John Sauer, made a number of arguments. One is that the role of judges to review some of these issues should be, in his view, very limited. Another essential argument he made was that presidents can only be prosecuted if they've already been impeached and convicted by the U.S. Senate, even in the most extreme of circumstances. And Sauer also pointed out that were these judges to disagree and open an avenue for criminal liability for former presidents, that it would open the floodgates to lots of recriminations and tit for tat from administration to administration of differing political parties.
And the judges peppered Trump's legal team with questions trying to test this immunity theory, with one judge asking if a president could order the killing of a political rival and get away with it as an official act.
Could a president who ordered SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival who was not impeached, would he be subject to criminal prosecution?
If he were impeached and convicted first. And
so your answer is no.
My answer is qualified yes. There is a political process that would have to occur under the structure of our Constitution, which would require impeachment and conviction by the Senate.
So, Carrie, there's no precedent here. Donald Trump is the first former president to face criminal charges. What will inform these judges' ruling?
Well, history is a guide here, Jeff. You know, no former president has been charged, but former President Richard Nixon did accept a pardon from his successor, Gerald Ford, which acknowledges some sense of criminal liability on his behalf and concern about a potential criminal action. And one of the judges in this case, Michelle Childs, also asked Trump's lawyer in this case why Trump's lawyer in the impeachment over January 6th conceded that he shouldn't be impeached there, but that there should be a role for the justice system to play criminally thereafter. Judge Childs couldn't get the lawyer to understand the distinction there or acknowledge it. And so there is a real contradiction the judges were grappling with today over the sweeping nature of Trump's arguments versus the reality on the ground in some of these very extensive hypotheticals.
And Carrie, you mentioned earlier that Trump's lawyers argued that prosecuting Mr. Trump would open a Pandora's box of indicting former presidents for actions they took while in office. How did the special counsel's team respond to that argument in particular?
The special counsel lawyer, James Pierce, basically said, this has never happened before in a couple of hundred years of American history. And the reason it's happened now is because of the unprecedented actions of former President Donald Trump, who now faces two federal indictments, this one in D.C. over January 6th and another in Florida over materials he allegedly refused to return to the FBI and stored at his resort in really unsecure areas of that facility, Mar-a-Lago. And so James Pierce said that were the court to accept Trump's view of his sweeping power, even post-presidency, it would present a really frightening, astonishingly frightening future for the country, that presidents would have a license to commit crimes and get away with it, basically.
We should note that Donald Trump attended this hearing today. It's an indication of how his campaign strategy is intertwined with his court appearances. You see a courtroom sketch of him there. What was it like inside the courtroom?
You know, Trump entered a few minutes before the hearing began around 9:30. He was relatively quiet. He wrote some notes to his attorneys. The only thing people could hear him say was, should I sit here or is this where I sit, to his legal team? And he held his fire until after he left the courthouse. He went to a hotel and then raised concerns about the political nature of his prosecution. Of course, there's no evidence that the current president, Joe Biden, played any role in this case, none whatsoever.
And a ruling could come within days, as I understand it, from this three-judge panel. What happens next? The losing side appeals to the Supreme Court?
That's right. But in some ways, delay is Donald Trump's friend, even if he loses here. And so it matters how quickly the court directs him to act, to take up an appeal either with the full D.C. Circuit Appeals Court or at the Supreme Court. Remember, this trial was set to start March 4th. That seems unlikely now, but prosecutors do want to get it going before the election. And how quickly the appeals court rules and what they say Trump can and can't do next could determine whether Trump faces any trials before November.
NPR's Carrie Johnson, always a pleasure to speak with you, Carrie. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Pentagon and Walter Reed Medical Center today revealed that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is suffering from prostate cancer. Austin's doctors say it was detected early and his prognosis is, quote, excellent. But there remains a chorus of criticism about why Austin withheld his diagnosis and much of his treatment for so long from the public and the president. Nick Schifrin has been following this story. Nick, let's start with the secretary's health. What do we know about how he's doing? And why are we just learning about this cancer diagnosis now?
So on your first question, Austin's doctors say they expect a full recovery, although they also said, quote, this can be a slow process. But there is no real answer to the second question, and that is why you're getting all of this criticism that you just referenced. And to understand that, let's go through the timeline again, as we did last night. In early December, that's 1 month ago, Austin learned he had prostate cancer. On December 22nd, he underwent a prostatectomy, the removal of part or all of the prostate under general anesthesia, and transferred his authorities to his deputy. On January 1st, he was admitted to the ICU at Walter Reed with what his doctors would diagnose as a urinary tract infection and fluid in his abdomen. On January 2nd, he again transferred his authorities to his deputy, but didn't say why. And on January 4th, he informed the National Security Council and his deputy about the hospitalization. And finally, January 5th, he makes his first public statement. And at no point during that entire process, Amna, did he say or admit that he had prostate cancer. Take a listen to the spokespeople today of the Defense Department and the National Security Council, Major General Pat Ryder and John Kirby, admitting how in the dark they have been.
As soon as we had this information to make available, we provided it. We got it this afternoon and provided it literally minutes before I stepped in here.
Nobody at the White House knew that Secretary Austin had prostate cancer until this morning, and the president was informed immediately after we were.
The Pentagon has cited the fact that Austin's chief of staff had the flu for the reason why some of the delay, but they do not have an explanation for why Austin did not admit he had cancer at any point in the last month.
We're so glad he has an excellent prognosis. We wish him a full and speedy recovery. But as you lay out, there seems to beg a lot more questions. What's been the response among lawmakers?
Very, very critical. Even after the fact that he had cancer was revealed today, House Armed Services Chairman Republican Mike Rogers today launched a formal inquiry. He accused Austin of, quote, concealing the fact that he was incapacitated. Today, the top Senate Armed Services Republican Roger Wicker accused Austin of a, quote, clear violation of the law. Even Democratic chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Jack Reed, today called for transparency and accountability from the Defense Department.
So bipartisan criticism there. What's the administration saying in response?
The administration is releasing a couple of steps that they say will answer some of the concerns. The White House released a memo obtained by PBS NewsHour by the chief of staff, laying out requirements for any cabinet secretary to inform the chief of staff if he or she, those cabinet secretaries, are unable to perform their duties. The Pentagon last night issued new requirements expanding the list of people who have to be informed when the secretary has to transfer his duties, and also requiring the disclosure of the reason. Those were not required before. And both the White House and the Pentagon are launching reviews that will last 30 days. But congressional officials I talked to today said that that is not enough, and there is still no answer, as we said, for why the second in the military chain of command withheld the fact that he had prostate cancer for the last month.
Looks like we'll be following the story ahead. Nick Schifrin, thanks as always.
Thanks very much.
In the day's other headlines, winter storms battered much of the country with everything from tornadoes to blizzards. One system killed at least three people in the south. Heavy rain and several reported twisters struck the Florida panhandle. Hurricane-force winds peeled roofs off homes, downed trees, and knocked out power to thousands. In the Midwest, more than half a foot of fresh snow fell in some areas, disrupting travel. Interstates and schools were closed in several states. Senate Republicans signaled today that Congress will need to pass another short-term funding bill to avoid a partial government shutdown. They've agreed on overall spending but need more time to pass 12 individual appropriations bills. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said a short-term continuing resolution would get them past the looming January 19th deadline.
They have a top-line agreement. In the meantime, we need to prevent a government shutdown. And so the obvious question is, how long does the CR need to be? And that'll be up to the majority leader and the speaker to determine the length of the CR.
Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson has said he would oppose any further short-term funding bills. He did not immediately comment on today's developments. The president of Ecuador says his nation is in a state of internal armed conflict tonight. That comes after masked men broke into a public television station with guns and shouted they had bombs. Police said later they'd arrested all the intruders. The president said he's designating 20 drug gangs as terror groups and ordering the military to neutralize them. In Ukraine, the power grid operator reports more than 1,000 towns have lost power amid Russian attacks on the electrical grid. Scenes of damage are widespread, and authorities say more than 500 drones and missiles struck Ukraine just over New Year's weekend. A Ukraine Air Force official says air defenses are stretched thin. A new South Korean law will ban the centuries-old practice of raising and selling dogs for food. Parliament voted today to ban the production and sale of dog meat. Animal rights groups pushed for the change, but reactions among the general public were mixed.
I'm raising my children and a dog together. The dog is my third child. I'm so glad the bill was passed today. Consuming dog meat should never happen again in the future.
I don't eat dog meat, but it's been consumed for a long time in our country. It's a unique part of our culture. It's not like everyone's consuming it. It's just a matter of preference.
The law is set to take effect after a 3-year grace period. NASA has decided to delay sending astronauts to circle the moon until 2025. That's a year later than planned. An attempt at a human landing on the moon is also being pushed back to 2026. Meanwhile, a Pittsburgh company gave up today on trying a moon landing with a robotic craft. It launched Monday, but a fuel leak ended its chances. On Wall Street, stocks lost Monday's momentum. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed nearly 158 points to close at 37,525. The Nasdaq rose 14 points, but the S&P 500 slipped 7. And Michigan is polishing its first college football championship trophy since 1997. The Wolverines cemented an undefeated season last night, beating the Washington Huskies 34-13. Afterward, white and gold confetti showered the field in Houston as Coach Jim Harbaugh and his players celebrated. Back in Ann Arbor, bars filled with students erupted in cheers. Still to come on the NewsHour, the increasing risk of criminal charges for women who experience a miscarriage. a revelatory eyewitness account of the Ukrainian resistance against Russia's invasion, and how women's sports are breaking into mainstream media coverage.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in Israel for his fourth visit since the war with Hamas started 3 months ago. It's part of a long regional tour that has Blinken walking an increasingly narrow diplomatic line as he tries to keep the conflict from spreading. William Brangham reports.
When he arrived in Israel, the Secretary of State bore a smile but a sharper message. Leaders across the Middle East are demanding an end to the fighting in Gaza and a clearer focus on what comes next.
I've just come from a number of countries in the region, Turkey, Greece, Jordan, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and I want to be able to share some of what I heard from those leaders with the president, as well as with the prime minister and the cabinet later today.
But in Tel Aviv, Israeli leaders aren't ready to listen to that advice. Defense Secretary Yoav Gallant told Blinken that while military strategies in the north of Gaza have shifted, operations in the south and center of the strip will intensify. Displaced Gazans in Khan Yunis, desperate to escape the fighting, sent a plea to Blinken for help.
My message to the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, get us back home to northern Gaza, even if to a tent. It's better than here.
Nice to see you.
Blinken received promises from Middle Eastern leaders for help rebuilding Gaza, but only if an eventual Palestinian state can exist alongside Israel, something Prime Minister Netanyahu has said he will not allow.
Israel must stop taking steps that undercut Palestinians' ability to govern themselves effectively. Extremist settler violence carried out with impunity, settlement expansion, demolitions, evictions, all make it harder, not easier, for Israel to achieve lasting peace and security.
Defending Israel to the global community has become an increasingly lonely position for the U.S. Today, the UK's Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, said Israel might have committed war crimes in Gaza.
If you're asking, am I worried that Israel has taken action that might be in breach of international law because this particular premises has been bombed or whatever? Yes, of course I'm worried about that, and that's why I consult the Foreign Office lawyers when giving this advice on arms exports.
As Israel continues its assault on southern and central Gaza, Palestinians seeking shelter have nowhere left to go.
This is the fourth time I have dismantled the tents and moved them. I am not ready to sacrifice my children and my grandchildren. We are leaving. We don't know what awaits us.
As fuel supplies dwindle, donkey carts have become one of the only ways Gazans can transport their belongings or their dead. On a bench outside central Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital, this aunt grieved the death of her 2-year-old nephew, Ahmad Issa Shaheen. The little boy was brought lifeless to the hospital. The rest of her family's fate is unknown.
I don't know if my sister or her children or if my father is coming. I'm waiting for them, but he was the only one they brought to the hospital.
We found only some skin from my daughter's head and some of her hair. We didn't find anything else. May God rest her soul. She was a top doctor.
Dr. Jamal Naeem carried the remains of his dead daughter here. He's lost 3 children, 3 grandchildren, and his mother, all killed in their sleep when their home was bombed.
We have no one except Allah. On the day of judgment, we're going to hold the Israelis to account, the Arabs and all the Muslims in front of God, and all those who didn't stand for us.
Nearby, another burial for another child. Dr. Mohammed Abu Jayab's sister's home was bombed, killing her 3-year-old son.
They say leave Midtown and go to Deir. Then they bomb Deir. Go to Rafah and then they hit Rafah. People don't know where to go and what to do.
Hand him to me. I won't cry, his sister promised. But no amount of kisses are enough for a mother's final farewell. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
2023 was the hottest year on record by a long shot. Europe's top climate agency released data today showing global temperatures averaged 1.48 degrees Celsius or 2.66 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels. Record high temperatures are expected to continue this year. For more on the implications of this record heat, I'm joined by Radley Horton. He's a professor at Columbia University's Climate School. Radley, welcome back. So the planet didn't just set a new global annual heat record, it shattered previous records. Did we expect to see that kind of increase this quickly?
No, we did not. At this point, we've gotten used to seeing records as warm as any prior year. We've gotten used to hearing this is the ninth straight, you know, the nine last years have been the nine warmest on record. But what we had happen this year is that over the last 6 months, we were half a degree Fahrenheit warmer than any of those previous years. So you can think of it like all the previous years were stacked pretty close together, and along comes a year in 2023 where the last 6 months were a full half a degree warmer than any of those previous years. So this was not expected.
So how do we account for that? What drove that increase this past year?
Yeah, well, we have to start, there's a few factors, but we have to start with human activities, the burning of fossil fuels. We're putting so much more heat in the system, and there's growing concern among scientists that we may have underestimated just how sensitive the climate, the Earth's temperature, is to greenhouse gases as they increase. Are our models missing some processes? But there are some other things going on besides that, those human activities. We had a moderately strong El Nino that's underway right now. That can be responsible for some warming of the planet, but not this much. And then similarly, we had a volcanic eruption under the ocean that actually put water vapor up into the atmosphere, which, unlike most volcanoes, is effective to some degree at warming the planet. But again, couldn't anywhere come close to explaining this degree of shattering of previous records.
So we know global warming doesn't just mean more heat and hotter records. We know it also means more extreme weather events. Where have we been seeing those? Where is it coming real for these communities?
Yeah, and there's so many examples. I'll highlight some of the cases where the records got shattered, just as the global average temperatures did. You look at the degree of some of these heavy rain events, these tragic floods in 2023, like we saw in Libya, for example, in Greece. Certainly heat waves front and center, right? We saw exceptional heat across southern Europe, across China, across the southern U.S. So, you know, this is hugely impactful for our economies, for our ecosystems. How about the forest fires that we saw across Canada? By some estimates, four times more burned area than ever before seen in Canada. It's directly related to the planet warming more than we thought it could, causing the air to dry out and essentially suck moisture out of that vegetation, priming the pump for these really extreme fires.
And we should underscore, we're talking about deadly events here. You also mentioned the economic component. I want to point out the U.S. alone had 28 weather disasters last year. The combined damage killed 492 people and caused nearly $93 billion in damage. In short, can we afford to continue at this pace?
Well, you know, no, we can't. We have to urgently reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. That's clearer than ever. We can see it, yeah, by looking at the damages this past year, economic and loss of life, and some of those things that don't get captured by metrics like GDP. But the additional concern, as you note, because this year was so much warmer than prior years, and because of growing evidence that we may have underestimated how vulnerable we as a society are to a little bit higher temperatures, it's becoming clear that if we want to avert these worst case scenarios and possible really catastrophic outcomes that are beyond what our climate models or our financial models or our crop models tell us is possible, we need to urgently reduce emissions and we have to adapt to these climate changes that are underway.
You know, Radley, that 1.48 degree increase is just barely below the 1.5 degrees limit that the world agreed upon as what they would like to avoid to, as you mentioned, avoid those worst case scenarios and the most severe outcomes. We talk about the tipping point a lot. Is this it?
Well, you know, I'd say we don't need to focus exactly on 1.5 degrees. really the key takeaway, I think, is that we are failing terribly at reducing our emissions. But you're right that it's becoming more and more clear than it was just, say, 5 years or so ago, that getting to 1.5 degrees is catastrophic for society. We have underestimated how vulnerable our systems are. We've underestimated how quickly these extreme events like heat waves and heavy rain are going to change. So in that sense, whether it's a tipping point or not, we're way more vulnerable than we realized, and it's even more urgent than we thought that we dramatically reduce our emissions.
Bradley Horton, professor at Columbia University's Climate School, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are learning more about what went wrong when a door panel blew off an Alaska Airlines flight midair. Officials are looking into whether 4 bolts that were supposed to hold the panel in place were actually missing. The investigation grounded at least 170 other planes from Alaska and United Airlines, and it's leading to many questions about Boeing and the role of the FAA. John Ostrower covers this all closely as the editor-in-chief of The Air Current. That's a site with reporting on the aerospace and aviation industries. Thanks so much for being with us. And John, we should say that you were the first to report that United Airlines found loose bolts during its early inspections of the 737 MAX 9. Alaska Airlines also said it found what it called loose hardware. Based on your reporting, what accounts for this? Faulty installations or poor design?
Well, I think you're hitting exactly on what Boeing, the FAA, Spirit AeroSystems, and the NTSB wants to understand. How did these bolts become loose? Did it happen during flight? Did it happen during manufacturing? Did it happen during assembly? And getting to the bottom of that is really the key question about what actually caused this door on the Alaska Airlines flight to depart the aircraft at 16,000 feet.
The CEO of Boeing today acknowledged the company's mistake. This was during a company-wide town hall meeting. What more can you tell us about that and what all this means for Boeing, which has come under fire for a series of safety issues connected to this very plane?
Well, yeah, today's town hall in the factory in Renton, Washington, where Boeing builds the 737, was a moment for Boeing to pause and talk to its employees about what they know, what they don't know, what they can say, and what they're doing to make sure that any issues in the factory don't become safety issues in the field. And I think that's something that they're going to continue to reiterate publicly. I think one of the really important things, I think, as we look at this and look at the span of the history that has befallen Boeing over not just the last 5 years with the grounding of the 737 MAX and twin accidents in Ethiopia and in Indonesia, is that coming off of that and rolling through the pandemic, there was really a major shift in how Boeing was producing the airplane, which was that production had halted during the grounding. And then the pandemic caused a huge turnover of staff. And those are both discrete events. But I think what's really important to put into context is that Boeing has tried to move beyond that the tragedies that befell Ethiopian Airlines and Lion Air back in 2019 and 2020. But what keeps recurring is a series of quality missteps that are not nearly as severe as what we saw in the crashes in 2019 and 2020, but certainly have not mitigated these quality escapes, so to speak, that cause tremendous disruption for Boeing, for the airlines. In this particular case, a very acute safety crisis for the MAX, for Alaska Airlines and the 171 people, passengers that were on board that airplane. I think when Boeing looks at how they move forward from this, I think it's important to put into context that Boeing's strategy fundamentally as a company has not changed. They've adopted new safety procedures and ombudsman and re-emphasized various tactical moves in terms of how they approach safety. But I think fundamentally, the company's strategy in terms of its goals for its both its shareholders and its customers has not changed in the last 20 years. And so that strategy currently is not, by all accounts, in the conversations that we're having with senior leaders all across the aviation industry, whether it be it Boeing's best customers or their suppliers or other stakeholders who are interested in their success as a national asset, are looking at a strategy that is producing the opposite results that they want to achieve. And so that's going to be really the legacy of this immediate issue once the aircraft it was expected to re-enter service when more is known and initial investigation takes
In the minute we have left, there are also questions about what this all means for the FAA, that United and Alaska, which are the two airlines that fly the specific aircraft, that they've both found loose parts in their early inspections of the grounded aircraft. It leads to questions about the FAA's inspection processes and its overall oversight. I mean, what does accountability look like for the FAA right now?
Well, certainly Congress is going to be asking questions about that in the weeks to come. I think from an oversight perspective, it's really important to remember that while the conversation has focused on Spirit AeroSystems, the supplier to Boeing and Boeing itself, when the MAX returned to service in the end of 2020, following the grounding, the FAA took back responsibility for key delegated tasks, including the final inspection and airworthiness ticketing of each and every delivery. So the FAA has played a role and been integrally involved in Boeing's factories and their deliveries since then. So certainly how they have approached this is going to be an important question going forward.
John Ostrower of the Air Current, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
The case of an Ohio woman has garnered national attention after she had a miscarriage and now faces criminal charges. 34-year-old Brittany Watts was 22 weeks pregnant, and her pregnancy had been deemed non-viable just days earlier when she miscarried in the bathroom of her home in September of 2023. 2 weeks later, she was arrested on charges of felony abuse of a corpse for how she handled the remains. If found guilty, she faces up to a year in prison. Joining me now is Mary Ziegler, a law professor at the University of California, Davis. Her most recent book is called Roe, The History of a National Obsession. Mary, welcome back and thanks for joining us. Help us understand this charge, abuse of a corpse. What are prosecutors accusing Brittany Watts of exactly?
Abuse of corpse charges are from very old laws that almost never apply in this circumstance, right? So if you think about abuse of a corpse, you're thinking of people mistreating remains for medical experimentation, or you're thinking of people after a homicide, you know, dismembering bodies to hide the crime. This almost never would be a charge you'd see applied in a miscarriage case. So essentially, I think what prosecutors are faulting Brittany Watts for is not grieving in the way they thought was appropriate following her miscarriage. Essentially, they're faulting her for the way she disposed of the fetal remains and the way she behaved after she did that.
We should note miscarriages this late in a pregnancy are rare. Most occur in the first trimester, but up to 30% of all pregnancies do end in a miscarriage. In Ohio or anywhere else, are there laws around this in terms of how you should be handling that miscarriage or reporting that miscarriage?
No. I mean, so if you are pregnant and you're looking for guidance about what to do when you experience a miscarriage, the only information you're likely to find is what you should do to protect your own health, essentially, when you should seek medical attention, when you may be experiencing a complication versus when you can handle whatever's happening at home. There's no kind of how-to guide about what you should do if you experience a miscarriage at home. So it's also, I think, unusual for prosecutors to be holding Brittany Watts to a standard that wasn't written down anywhere when she made the choices she did.
So critics have looked at this case and said this represents a criminalization of pregnancy. We've seen an increase in over the years. Do you agree with that? Have we been seeing that trend?
We have, and I think Brittany Watts' case is remarkable in a couple of ways. There's a history, as the group Pregnancy Justice has documented, of laws criminalizing the actions of pregnant patients, particularly usually actions that were taken by low-income people, people of color, particularly substance abuse, sometimes of illegal drugs, sometimes of legal drugs like alcohol. You almost never, or to my knowledge, never see a prosecution of someone like Brittany Watts. Everyone has conceded that this pregnancy was already non-viable when the actions she took that have led to charges began. So this is, I think, both a continuation of a trend, but also an acceleration of a trend. This is something we haven't seen much before.
That group you mentioned is an advocacy group, Pregnancy Justice. In their last year's report, they found there were more than 1,300 cases where pregnancy, including pregnancy loss, was used in a criminal investigation or prosecution. That was from 2006 to June of 2022, the month that Roe v. Wade was overturned. Tell me about what we've seen since then. Where do these kinds of prosecutions fit into the larger effort to further roll back abortion access?
The U.S. anti-abortion movement's goal from its really since the 1960s onward has been not just the undoing of a right to choose abortion, but the recognition of a fetus or an unborn child as a rights-holding person. And in pursuit of that goal, they've sought to write this idea of a fetus as a rights-holding person into as many areas of law as possible. The ultimate goal here is essentially to make the law of abortion, which doesn't treat a fetus as a rights-holding person, or the law of the Constitution, the interpretation of the Constitution, that doesn't treat a fetus as a rights-holding person, an outlier, right? To make it weirder and weirder to say, well, this fetus doesn't have constitutional rights, but we treat it as a person for the purposes of abusing a corpse. We treat it as a person for the purposes of fetal homicide law or wrongful death law or intestacy law, to sort of put incremental pressure on a conservative Supreme Court to move toward the recognition of personhood. So this is very much playing the long game. This is not a movement that thinks it's going to get the recognition of fetal personhood through Congress or through the Supreme Court in the near term. But it's worth remembering, of course, that it took 50 years to undo Roe v. Wade. So I think this, in some ways, for the anti-abortion movement is the new Roe v. Wade. It's the next 50 years.
While we have you, I'd like to ask you about the latest news we have on those battle over abortion bans. The Supreme Court late last week allowed Idaho to continue to enforce its near total abortion ban. The court's going to hear the case in their April session. But from what you've seen in other states in terms of women traveling out of state or having to file legal cases to challenge for the right to terminate pregnancies, what do you expect to see? What's the impact on the ground in Idaho?
Well, what we're seeing, I think, in Idaho is likely to be of the most serious import for people experiencing complications in wanted pregnancies, people who may have been able to fit in under the kind of understanding of a medical emergency that the Biden administration has championed under this federal law, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, but who may not under Idaho's law. I think it's also likely to have an effect on physicians who are not going to want to risk the kind of criminal consequences that Idaho's law authorizes for making the wrong decision. It's not unlikely that we'll see the Supreme Court maybe uphold this law or at least reject the Biden administration's interpretation of federal law and permit Idaho's interpretation to take effect come June when the court renders a decision.
That is Mary Ziegler, law professor at the University of California, Davis, joining us tonight. Mary, thank you. Always good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
The all-out war in Ukraine will enter its third year next month, the battle lines nearly as frozen as the nation itself during this frigid winter. But 2 years ago, there was concern that Kyiv wouldn't even last a week. Nick Schifrin brings us a book that explores how Kyiv survived, written by a foreign correspondent covering the war in the country of his birth.
Ukraine's national anthem is a dark but determined call for freedom. It begins with the line, "Ukraine has not yet perished." But it continues, "Fate shall smile on Ukraine, and our enemies will vanish." Our enemies will vanish. That is the title of a new book out today about the war by Yaroslav Trofimov, the Wall Street Journal's chief foreign affairs correspondent, who's reporting from Ukraine before and since Russia's full-scale invasion has been indispensable, helping define our understanding of the war. And Yaro joins me here in the studio. It's such a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. The book's extraordinary because of the breadth of the reporting. We'll get to some of the specifics in a second. But it's also extraordinary because it is personal. You were born in Ukraine. This is actually a photo of you. That's you in the glasses right down there in art class as a kid. And you write in the book, "It felt wrong to wear on the streets of my hometown the vest and helmet by the botanical garden where I used to go on dates, by the museum where I used to spend afternoons. The Russians thought it was theirs, in a country they believed didn't exist, part of a nation they told themselves had been invented. How dare they?" I thought. How personal is this story for you?
Very much so, very much so. And I've spent, you know, much of my career covering wars and insurrections in other countries. And I always prided myself on thinking of, well, you know, Ukraine is such a peaceful place. It will never happen there. And then one day it did, and I was prepared for that. But still, there's sort of this sense of personal insult. Like, why? This is a city that is being bombarded and destroyed, and its people have done nothing to Russia.
Beginning with before the war, something that you reveal is that there was a difference between Ukrainian and U.S. intelligence before the war. The Americans had intelligence of what senior officials around Putin were telling Putin. But the Ukrainians had lower level intelligence, and they knew that those generals, those senior officials, were actually lying to Putin. Explain that, and how did that play out?
Well, basically, the U.S. had a very high-grade intelligence, so they knew what the generals were telling Putin. And the generals were telling Putin that the Russian army, with all the investment, with all the money that was poured into it in the previous decades, has a capacity to rout Ukraine very quickly. And also, they were telling him the Ukrainians will not be resisting very much. What the Ukrainians knew from contacts in the lower levels of the Russian military was that a lot of that money had been stolen, that the Russian forces were not nearly as strong as advertised, and also a lot of the Russian spy network in Ukraine that was meant to facilitate this rapid takeover was actually not going to work for the Russians.
You were there before the full-scale invasion, the day of, and of course, for months after, and you write extensively about how close some of the Russians came to Kyiv, to downtown Kyiv. At one point, you point out the Russians had a 12-to-1 troop advantage right outside of Kyiv. How close did the Russians come to their initial goals in the capital?
Well, they came pretty close. The main Russian plan was to take over the Hostomel airfield, and it was a pretty small Ukrainian National Guard detachment made up of conscripts that managed to prevent the Russians from landing planes with reinforcement there. That was a really pivotal moment in the very first morning of the war. And then the Russians were there. They were there for almost a month. They had crossed the river of Irpin to the east, to the west of Kyiv, and established a foothold. And it was a tremendous effort by everyone, the, you know, police, firefighters, volunteers, everyone who could hold a gun, to repel them at a very high cost.
One of the success stories that Ukrainians mm-hmm. had by October 2022 is outside of Kharkiv and specifically in Liman. What did you see when you were one of the first reporters into some of these areas liberated by the Ukrainian soldiers?
Me and Manu Bravo, the Spanish photographer who was with me throughout this war, drove very early in the morning into Liman. And we're really among the first to enter. There were a few Ukrainian special forces just, you know, clearing the center of the city. They were burning Russian vehicles and sort of driving on the road. And we saw blown up Russian armored vehicles, one, another, and another. I kind of stopped thinking, is it safer not to go there? And then we saw a man crawling from behind one of his vehicles without a leg, bleeding. You know, he clearly was either part of the Russian forces or one of the looters trying to steal items from there.
You write about and reported extensively from Bakhmut as well. Mm-hmm. And even a year ago, you spoke to soldiers who were criticizing the Ukrainian focus on Bakhmut in eastern Ukraine as taking away some of the focus for more strategic goals in the south. Why do you think President Zelensky had a sense that he could ignore some of the military advice he was getting?
I think for President Zelensky, it was a political decision, and Bakhmut was turned to a symbol of Ukrainian resistance. And the whole idea was, you know, Ukraine is going ahead, is not retreating. And it was at a big cost to the Ukrainian military, for sure, but it was also to a big cost to Russia. If you remember, the main Russian force that was, the only Russian force that was on the ground in Bakhmut was Wagner, which was the only Russian force that was capable of offensive operations in Ukraine since the spring of 2022. And Wagner was destroyed in Bakhmut.
The book's subhead is The Russian Invasion and Ukraine's War for Independence. And you write, looking back on the one-year anniversary mm-hmm. of the full-scale invasion, it was clear Ukraine had won the war for its independence. Ukraine wasn't going to disappear from the map once again. That is, of course, still true today, 2 years almost after the full-scale invasion. But I wonder if you think that it's good enough, or whether Ukraine and Ukrainians who you talk to think that that is good enough?
Well, it's never good enough, obviously. And Ukrainians do want to regain the other 18% of the country that are under Russian rule. You know, there are many Ukrainians living there in terrible conditions under occupation. But the country has survived, and it is continuing to survive at a tremendous cost because, you know, though the front line hasn't moved much in the last year, there are battles every day, and people are dying every day.
And so the war continues.
So the war goes on.
Yaroslav Trofimov, the book is Our Enemies Will Vanish. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The NCAA announced a new 8-year broadcast deal with ESPN last week for over $900 million, with women's college sports making up the bulk of the deal. While women's athletics have traditionally been on the sidelines of sports media, in recent years they have scored some big wins with mainstream audiences, effectively tripling their coverage in the process. Stephanie Tsai dives into the rise of women's sports and the fandom propelling them forward.
So yeah, like I was at this championship game, 2017.
Minnesota resident Jillian Hiscock is a diehard fan of women's sports.
I'm a huge WNBA fan and women's basketball fan in general, but I follow everything.
But catching a woman's basketball game at her local sports bar proved complicated.
So many women's sports fans' experience has been walking into a bar, looking around at the 20-plus TVs, and knowing that it is very likely the game you want to watch is not on TV.
That is, until she took a trip to Portland, Oregon, and walked into the Sports Bra, the world's first women's sports bar.
It was literally transformative walking in and just knowing that this is a place where my fandom is celebrated.
It's not a sports bar for women. It's a bar for women's sports.
Owner Jenny Nguyen opened the Bra in 2022. There, she maintains the sports bar aesthetics, but keeps the TVs tuned only to women's sports coverage. But keeping those screens filled with women's sports took a game plan.
If it was just what was on TV and what was on cable, there would not be enough to open the Sports Bra. So I reached out to some of the bigger women's sports media brands that do their own YouTube channels, that kind of thing.
Welcome to the Just Women's Sports Super Show.
While traditional broadcast media has often treated women's sports as a bench warmer, new media has given it more play.
Streaming platforms have completely changed the game with respect to women's media coverage.
By including all the ways fans now consume sports, media and marketing researcher Shelley Passara says women's sports grew from just 4% to 15% of all sports coverage in the past 4 years.
It is amazing, and yes, it's triple where we've been before, but it is only 15%.
When we look back, we'll look at 2023 as a watershed moment for women's sports.
The rise in coverage comes as no surprise to veteran sports journalist Christine Brennan. It's the fruition of a landmark piece of legislation known as Title IX, signed by Richard Nixon in 1972, giving women and girls the right to equal opportunity in sports in publicly funded schools.
We are now in the beginning of the next 50 years of Title IX. It makes complete sense that we would be seeing this explosion in women's sports.
Brennan herself was a high school athlete just after Title IX was passed, but she didn't get to enjoy the benefits as the new rules took years to be enforced.
I'm honored to have been kind of at the very beginning, just getting that first glimpse of what would come in the decades that followed.
And what followed are big, headline-stealing moments, like the showdown between Iowa's Caitlin Clark and Louisiana State University's Angel Reese in the NCAA basketball final, Katie Ledecky beating Michael Phelps for most individual world swimming titles, and Simone Biles' comeback to become the most decorated gymnast in history.
Today's the greatest day to be a woman in sports until tomorrow. But the mainstream sports media has not caught up.
While few women's sports receive primetime slots, their ratings have continuously exceeded expectations. The 2023 WNBA Finals were the most watched in 20 years. The National Women's Soccer League saw a 20% increase in TV ratings this season. Women's college volleyball is continuously shattering its own viewership ratings. And that NCAA Women's Basketball Final? It averaged 9.9 million viewers, more than the five-game average for last year's World Series.
The rise of social media has been a fabulous turn of events for women's sports and women's sports fans, because in the old days, it just wouldn't be covered.
Things that live rent-free in my head include when Angel City beat the Thorns 5-1.
18-year-old Ellie Carson is active on TikTok, where she posts exclusively about her favorite sport, women's soccer.
I just posted a video and then a lot of people were commenting and I was like blown away because I really didn't have other people in my life who liked women's soccer. And I was like, oh my God, there's other people.
Carson was first drawn to the sport during the 2019 World Cup. Equal pay! Equal pay! when the U.S. women's team was campaigning to earn as much as their male counterparts.
It definitely draws you to a team when they stand for more than just the sport that they play.
I love all things women's basketball. We can be competitors, like we can talk junk.
For South Carolina resident Jaquinda Jackson, watching female ballers is empowering, and for her sons, enlightening.
Showing two little boys that women can and will compete, it diminishes that whole stereotype of women are like just one way.
They're playing at such a high level, it makes it really easy and really entertaining to watch.
Brent Rowe has been a sports fan his whole life, but more recently he became one of the men who make up roughly half the audience for women's sports. He's now a season ticket holder for his local WNBA team, the Las Vegas Aces, and a fan of their championship-winning Aja Wilson.
The Aces were the first professional sports team to bring a championship to the city and the first ones to have a parade on the Las Vegas Strip. How cool is that? I'm rocking an Aja Wilson jersey when I'm walking down the street.
Men like Rowe represent a sea change for women's sports and are key to its growth, says Brennan.
These are Title IX males who were raised very differently than their fathers or grandfathers, and they will be fighting to make sure there's advertising for women's sports.
While college sporting events are, thanks to Title IX, split evenly between men and women, professional sports are dominated by men's leagues. But Jillian Hiscock is banking on that changing.
In here, we'll have all kinds of memorabilia, art on the walls.
Inspired by her visit to the Sports Bra in Portland, she's getting ready to open a bar of their own, the Midwest's first female sports bar. In Minneapolis.
I was that young girl athlete that never really had representation in any kind of professional sports, in sports bars, and the ability to really expose our younger generation to these women athletes is really important to me.
A bar of their own will open its doors this March in what is expected to be another banner year for women's sports. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
Later this evening on PBS, Independent Lens presents a film about the lengths people will go to flee North Korea. Beyond Utopia focuses on a pastor helping families as they embark on a dangerous, treacherous journey across China and Southeast Asia, leaving their homelands behind.
There is no freedom of religion. There's no freedom of thought. There's no freedom of press. There's only one paper, one radio station. There's one TV station.
North Korea may be the only country in the world that completely bans outside broadcasts.
지도 못하고 도시도 못하게 하라. 그냥 독재정권 유지하기 위해서 그러는 거죠.
And spying on one another is very much a part of life in North Korea.
Beyond Utopia airs on PBS tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern. Check your PBS station listings. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.